Good evening and welcome. Thank you all for coming. My name is Sue Scott, and I'm the director of the Western Illinois Museum, and appreciate you coming out for this program this evening. I always like to start with thanking our members. These programs, this museum, and our collection could not be possible without the support of those who contribute every year to this organization. So thank you for that, and you have a special welcome from me. This event has been a partnership with Tri-State's Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. It was a very exciting idea when Abby and Heather approached us because there are some parallels in the things that we're both interested in. We think it's really important to collect and preserve and let people learn from our own culture and our history. And Abby, I'll let her speak for herself, but I think those are some of her concerns as well. So I'm going to turn it over to Abby and let her be the MC for the night. So enjoy yourselves, and thanks for coming. Abby, are you ready?
So there's, like, way too many of you guys here. I'm nervous. All the storytellers are nervous. I think we might give the moth a run for their money, which is awesome. But welcome to My Farm Roots, Tri-State's Public Radio, Harvest Public Media, and Western Illinois Museum's first storytelling event here in Macomb. Super excited to have you guys here. And thanks, Sue. It was wonderful that she agreed to partner with us in this event tonight. So before we get started with the storytellers, in between the storytellers, I'm going to ask trivia questions. And the person who gets the trivia question correct will get a seed corn stress ball. I like to use them to throw at my colleagues. And I welcome you to do that too. However, if you win the stress ball by answering the question correctly, you do not have my permission to throw it at the storyteller if you don't like the story or for whatever reason. No. So the first question is, for a conventional corn and soybean operation, what's the most expensive input after land, and equipment doesn't count because you don't buy that every year if you're lucky?
Water. Seed.
Who said fertilizer first? Like eight people. It's between the two of you. There we go. Okay, our first storyteller for tonight is Terry Van Meenen Misfelt. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You got it.
That's amazing. And you guys all have bios of the storytellers in your programs, which the programs are lovely. I'm so pleased with them. So I asked, if you could farm anything, what would it be? And Terry said, pumpkins and Christmas trees with reindeers, and she would have children, presumably misbehaved children, they would come around and they would have to clean up the reindeer poop. So without further ado, here's Terry.
Okay, so my name is Terry Van Meenen Misfelt, and in the spirit of the holidays, I wanted to share my grandmother's favorite Christmas song with you all. and that was exactly how she danced, too, by the way. So anyone who knows me knows that my grandma was my best friend. Growing up in rural Geneseo, I spent a lot of time on my grandparents' farm. Because of that, my grandmother and I developed a very close relationship. And so anyone who knows my grandmother knows she did not want to go farming, but we never would have had the opportunities to interact with each other and develop that relationship the way that we did without the farm. So whether it was picking raspberries together, searching in the barns for baby kittens every spring, those are a really big part of who I am. In August of last year, she passed away at the age of 96. She'd grown up during the Great Depression. She had an eighth grade education, was fiercely independent, devoted to family, and always had a great sense of humor when dealing with life's challenges. They'd moved into town about 20 years before that, and up until age 95 when she had a stroke, she still would go out to the farm and pick vegetables and mow. So she was tough. Right before she ended up going to the hospital for her stroke, she left a letter because she wanted to make sure that her voice was heard and she wanted to make sure that our family knew her story. And so I'm going to share that letter with you tonight. When I was a little girl, there were 13 children in my family. I was third from the youngest. We lived on a farm and we had our chores to do. We had to put up a lot of wood and cobs on the porch to burn in our stove. That's what we burnt to keep warm. We didn't have no toys at that time. We had large orange boxes for our table. Then we made pies out of mud. Sometimes Mom would give us crackers to eat. That was a treat. So my grandparents immigrated to the U.S. from the Netherlands. They spoke Dutch in their home, so she grew up bilingual. And at Christmas, they got oranges. So that was a tradition that she kept alive, and Santa would visit us every Christmas Eve during our family gatherings, and he would distribute oranges to the grandchildren along with a small item. And it was a good reminder of how far we had come and how lucky we were to have all of the gifts under the tree that we did. We had to walk a mile to school. We had to dress warm. And so Grandma's older sister hated that walk so very much that she stopped attending school. And it's my understanding that she never learned to read. When we went to church on Sunday, we had like a three-seater car. There was three of us that had to sit on the tip of the seat. Then after church, my dad would stop uptown then. We had a nickel to spend. So we would go to the store and buy one-cent things. We don't go away very much. And so one of the stories Grandma liked to tell was of the women in her family kind of meeting at the soda fountain after church when they would be in town. And so they only really lived about 5 miles north of Geneseo. They didn't go into town that frequently. So the ladies would get together and they would go to the soda fountain and get vanilla sodas. And so when I started working at the Dairy Queen in high school, I made a vanilla soda one day and took it to her, an old-fashioned kind, right? And so she took a sip of it, and she started to cry, and she told me that she had not had one of those since she was a very, very young girl. And so something that seemed so simple and small carried so much memory for her and had been such a treat growing up during a very challenging economic time. Our games was we would play house, hide-and-seek, and ball. We had to warm water before we washed in a shed outside the house. When we cleaned house, we had to beat rugs that was on the clothesline and take mattresses outside. That was a terrible job. When we woke up in the morning, there would be snow on the floor. Our windows didn't fit tight. This is my life with Grandpa. So she kind of jumps here to the really important part, right? Because Grandpa's a pretty cool guy. Got married in 1938. Was married 5 years. Then Grandpa was called to World War II. I worked in the shop. Grandpa was gone 2 years. I stayed alone. And so my Grandpa Ed was stationed in the Pacific during World War II. And Grandma moved from rural Henry County to San Luis Obispo, California. And so it was quite a big culture shock for her. She didn't just work in a shop. She worked at the Coca-Cola bottling plant, the dry cleaners, and the bakery. And so it was a pretty big change being away that far from family, and that didn't have the technology that we do now. And then also, you know, to be without this person that she cared about so very much and being worried about them a lot. And so those stories are things that she shared with me quite frequently, especially around the holidays. She hated the song, I'll Be Home for Christmas, and could not hear it without starting to cry. And so that was something that clearly had a lot of meaning for her. And so when I moved to New York in 2003 to attend school, she would talk to me on the phone. That was my person, right? That was my frame of reference. So here I am, a country kid, and I'm now in the same situation that she had found herself in as a young woman, very far away from family and kind of a lot of my cultural element, as it were. And so I think even with the distance, that was the time when we became closest. And a lot of that was sharing her personal stories with me, and then also kind of bonding over what I missed about being in the country. When Grandpa came back, he wanted to go farming. We had nothing in our home. No running water, no bathroom. I had to heat my water before I washed. It was so cold when I washed. Things got better. And so in typical grandma humor with life's challenges. I think that her ending to her little letter kind of says it all. They raised hogs and cattle. When the chickens stopped laying eggs, grandma would cut their heads off and make dinner. And eventually they built a modular home on the property. Oh, they got running water first in the house. Then they built a modular home. Then they sold those two houses and moved into town. And our family still owns the property. We still go out and pick vegetables. I don't get there as often as I would like, but I know, always know that no matter how far away I go, that my memories of the farm and my memories of my grandmother are my happy place. Thank you.
My dad grew up during the Great Depression, too, and I don't know if anybody here does this, but I, like, wash out my plastic bags, you know, like the Ziploc bags or whatever, and then, like, hang them up over the... Yeah. Thank you, Terry. That was great. Okay, our second trivia. Guest appearance, by the way. Matching guest appearance. When was the USDA established? And it's older than you think. 1906, you said? Nope.
1937.
1937? Nope. Older? 1958? No, like older. Oh, okay. Pardon?
1863 or 4.
Oh, you're so close.
1865.
Who said 63 or 64?
I did.
You're getting a soybean. May 15th, 1862. Wow. I don't know for sure, but I think it's got to be like one of the first federal agencies. Can I do this?
Oh, be careful.
Ready? Thank you. I will be having a career with the Cubs coming.
The Cardinals need somebody now,
Rich says. Okay, our next storyteller, George Henin Fent. George is, it's in the program, but he's one of my favorite folks in town. He's the announcer at the corn husking competition every year, which if you've never been to, you should definitely find out about. We have a national corn husking champion in the room. Frank, his brother, is sitting over there. Woohoo. That's right. Illinois, represent. George said that he would farm cattle, because there's something about seeing a crop of calves in the spring. They all have a personality. Here's George.
Smithshire. When my brothers and I were growing up on the farm, we used to go with my father to Smithshire, Illinois, late at night to unload cattle from a freight train. My dad would buy cattle out west. The sellers would load them on a train and ship them back to Smithshire. Next to the station house, there was a stack of railroad ties about 6 feet tall. We would climb up on top of that stack, and we would sit on the edge or lay on our backs and watch the night stars while we waited for the train to come. My brother, Nick, would oftentimes sneak away while my dad wasn't looking, and take some pocket-warm pennies and place them on the cool steel rails of the track. Eventually, we would hear a rumble to the west, or there would be a flash of light, and the train would be coming. The headlamp of the engine would swing like a giant cyclops eye. The train would roar into the station like a cloud of metal thunder. The engineer would wave at us and smile as he went by. We would think the train wasn't going to stop. The engineer would pull back on the throttle. The whine of the engine would drop an octave. The cars would continue to go by us. Clickety-clack, 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 and then slower. Clickety-clack, 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 and then slower. Clickety-clack, 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 until the caboose would glide to a stop just shy of the side track. The brakeman would jump out of the caboose, go around to the front and disconnect it from the last car on the train. He would wave a big lantern back and forth. The engine would rev up about a half mile away, and the train would pull forward. The slack would go out of the couplings, and you could hear metal bang on metal, kaboom, 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 through the night air. The brakeman, using a long metal rod, would switch the tracks so that the side track was now connected to the main line. The engine would start up again after he waved his lantern back and forth, and it would push its rear end onto that side track. The brakeman would then decouple that last car, wave his lantern again, and the train would pull back onto the main track. The brakeman would use that metal rod again and switch the tracks so that the side track was disconnected and the main line was one line again. He would wave his lantern. The train would back up and it would bump into the caboose. The couplings would fold around themselves. The brakeman would connect the lines and he would lock the coupling. Standing on the bottom step of the stairs leading into the caboose, he would lean out as far as he could and wave his lantern. The train would then pull forward into the night, leaving us with the cattle car sitting on the sidetrack full of 400 to 500 pound calves. We would open a door on the side of the cattle car. The calves, timid as deer, would stick out their noses and come down the chute into the corral. We had hay and water waiting for them there. They would spend the night in that corral. I often worried that my brother was going to derail the train by putting stuff on the tracks. We would look for the coins afterward, but generally, we wouldn't find any. Once in a while, we would find one that was flat, but mostly they were just gone. In the morning, we would come back and we would drive the cattle through downtown Smithshire to our farm, which was on the south side of town. At that time, the downtown of Smithshire consisted of a gas station, a grocery store, a blacksmith shop, and a post office. My dad would ride a horse. Us boys would be on the side of the calves or in the side streets to keep them going south. A lot of times, men who were in the gas station just loafing would come out and help us. About that time, there was a man who lived near Smithshire who I'm going to call Teddy. Teddy was pretty well off. His family had died, or his parents had died, and left him a farm. But he did not like farming. He liked racehorses. So he raised some horses on his farm, and he had connections with people in Florida who raised racehorses and were in the racehorse business. I was in the elevator one day, and I heard the owner of the elevator tell Teddy, "If you will raise a horse, name him Smithshire, and he wins a race, I will give you $5,000. Teddy said, "I have just the colt out at the farm right now. I'm going to name him Smithshire, and he's going to win a race." I didn't hear much about Teddy for several years after that. After I came back to the area from law school and started practicing, the local funeral home director came to me, and he said, "I buried Teddy, but his daughter hasn't paid me for the funeral. Can you help me?" I went up to the courthouse, and I looked through the court file. I found out that several people had filed petitions against the daughter to have her removed as the executor of the estate. There was even an order entered by a judge for a rule to show cause as to why she should not be held in contempt of court for failure to appear and properly administer the estate. There had been some assets in the estate, but apparently they had disappeared along with the daughter. I filed a motion with the court to have my client appointed as the administrator of the estate to collect his debt. We did some investigating. We found out that Teddy had a house in Florida, but Teddy hadn't paid the real estate taxes for several years. It was about to be sold to pay the back taxes. My client came up with the money to redeem the house from the tax sale. We hired an attorney in Florida so that he could help us sell the house. We sold the house, and we received enough money to pay the funeral, my fees, and all of the other creditors, and there was money left over for the daughter. We hired a private investigator to find the daughter, but he couldn't locate her anywhere. We learned in going through this process that Teddy had been murdered in his home in Florida. He had been in the racehorse business with an Irishman down there. The Irishman and the horses had disappeared. The attorney told us that apparently they had all gone back to Ireland. As far as I know, Teddy's murderer was never found. I filed a report with the court showing what we had done and the income we had and the expenses we had paid, and I set it for a hearing. We sent a notice out to everyone, including the last known address of the daughter. On the day of the hearing, no one appeared, but there was a lady sitting in the back of the courtroom. When the judge called Teddy's case, he said, "Is there anyone appearing here on Teddy's estate?" The lady in the back stood up. The judge said, "Who are you?" She said, "I'm Teddy's daughter." He said, "Why are you here?" She said, "I object to the attorney fees." The judge said, "You've got to be kidding me. If it wasn't for the attorney and his client, there wouldn't be anything for you to fight over. I'm going to approve the attorney fees, and I'm going to direct that they be paid immediately from the estate." We never learned if the horse named Smithshire won a race. The little town on the prairie called Smithshire is still a little town on the prairie, but it's smaller than it ever was. The train does not stop there anymore. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the story named Smithshire.
No secrets in the courtroom. Sometimes that's what I do as a journalist. I just read public records. And you can find out the most interesting things. The health department, the Illinois Health Department, they were concerned about, this was when the Ebola outbreaks were going on and everything, and they were kind of concerned about O'Hare and people coming through. And they kind of worked their way through that in maybe three sentences, and then they spent like 12 pages talking about raw milk regulations in the state and what they should be. For Illinois, Frank's gonna know this. For Illinois in 2015, what was the average per acre bushel? Does that make sense to everybody? How much corn did they harvest per acre? How many bushels of corn did Illinois harvest per acre? Close? 180 is close? 165 is close?
210.
Last year, we got close to that.
170.
Yes! Woo! 170 was the answer, by the way. And I think that maybe is like unofficial, but it's kind of the official unofficial. I think the final numbers come out in December. Our next storyteller, and then we'll have a little intermission afterwards and some music by the Lane Family Band. And it is a very full Lane family, and we are so happy for that. Our next storyteller is Jane Carlson, and Jane would grow Mary Jane, which is legal in Illinois. Here's Jane.
A lot of times when I tell people that I grew up on a farm, they get this look in their eye, like, aw. That must have been such an idyllic, wholesome childhood. Like, I can see these little visions dancing in their heads. Like, maybe they're picturing me milking a cow with a bonnet, or what I would have looked like as an 8-year-old with braids and riding through a meadow on a horse or something like that. My memories are a lot more gruesome than that. They're kind of bloody, stinky, dirty. My parents both had college degrees. They both had full-time jobs. They never intended to be farmers, but this was the early 1980s in Knox County, Illinois, West Central, Illinois, Forgottonia, and those two full-time jobs weren't enough. Their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had farmed in Illinois and New York and in Sweden, and we already lived out in the country. So when we needed some extra money, my parents turned to farming. We did it, again, to put some extra money in the bank, and we did it to put food in the freezer, which is to say we were kind of freelance farmers. We never had a huge operation. We never had acres and acres of soybeans. We never had a hog confinement. We never had big tractors. We never had big sheds. We had cows at some point. We had pigs always and chickens always. We grew some corn. We were always fixing things. We were always trying to make do. The entire operation consisted of my dad, very capable man, as the chief operating officer, my mother, a multi-talented woman, as the chief financial officer, and three very strong-willed daughters. But back to that gruesomeness. My mother was a high school English teacher, so she quoted Shakespeare. She also directed the church choir and played the organ. She led the 4-H club, and she knew how to sew. She could tell a mean joke. But my most enduring memory of my mother from my childhood is me standing maybe 25, 30 feet back and watching her very methodically, very determined, very deliberately cutting off the heads of chickens and seeing this kind of spray of blood splash up into her face. That memory is associated with one of my least favorite things about growing up on a farm, and that is plucking chickens. Horrible. I remember sitting on the side of the house on a hot summer day, kind of elbows deep in these kind of sticky, stinky birds, and wondering, why was I born into this family? Why was I not born into a family that lived in town and had carpeting and central air and cable television and a swimming pool? That swimming pool fantasy that my sisters and I had never really stopped throughout our childhood. I mean, we had diagrams drawn of where we would put it on the farm. We made concessions. We didn't care if it was underground. It would just be a nice little 3-foot above ground pool. It would go right here. Somehow, you know, that would make all of it okay if we could do that. My parents were not going to give us a swimming pool. They would say, you know, go swim in the creek. It's fine. And that was nice, maybe not as refreshing as the swimming pool thing. But one summer, my sisters and I thought we would be a little rebellious and pull a hog tank out of the pig yard and fill it with hose water, maybe a couple capfuls of bleach from the laundry room to make it smell like a swimming pool. And there, we just did it on our own. And really, that's what my parents were doing, too. They were doing it on their own. And maybe it was a little bit more like bathing than swimming, but that's what we did. We made do. When we first got into farming, my dad brought home one pregnant sow. And I'll be honest, my sisters and I were really excited. It wasn't a pony, it wasn't a puppy, but that first sow a big black sow. Her name was Lucinda, and we loved her. We put her up in this little outbuilding near the woods behind my parents' property, and we loved the piglets when they came in, too. I remember getting off the bus and just bounding over there to see how they were doing after school. Soon we had more and more pigs, and my dad built a small farrowing house and a pig yard and more of the front side of our yard. We continued the somewhat unconventional and maybe a little more complicated practice of naming our animals that we raised as livestock, and my favorite was Bertha, a.k.a. Bertha the Bench, because she would slide up with her back against the side of a pig shed and let me sit on her belly while I scratched her ears. If you're sensing that I may have had some boundary issues with the livestock that we raised, you are correct. In fact, I used to get in trouble when I was a kid for sneaking the piglets, especially the runts, into my bedroom at night. The absolute worst thing, according to me and my sisters when we were younger, though, is this thing we like to call the pigs are out. Always happened when it was cold. Always happened in the middle of the night, but some pig trampled down the fence, and then here all these things that were our livelihood, the things that were supposed to help us get ahead in the world, are running around free around the compound. So we'd all go trampling out there in the cold, boots, mismatched mittens, nightgowns, hats. My dad had his little zapper chasing the pigs all around the yards. And it's funny now, sometimes I'll just call my sisters and say, the pigs are out. As a teenager, you start to realize that the way you see yourself is not how other people see you. And that was pretty apparent on the farm. I remember being picked up for a date one time and watching from the house as this guy that was picking me up just stopped. There's this whole flock of truly free-range chickens trying to cross the driveway, and he didn't know what to do. Or driving around with my friends and turning on the air conditioning and get this blast of manure smell in my face. One time I brought friends home from college, and we kind of bounded into the house and found two calves in my parents' breezeway. They were absolutely adorable, and my parents had named them T-Bone and Ribeye. I'm a vegetarian now, by the way. My dad was the muscle and the mind behind our operation, but we all chipped in, whether we wanted to or not. When I was around 9 or 10, I became the family's designated castration assistant. Very proud I was. I would hold the cute little pigs by their back legs between my knees with my back against a fence, and my dad would come up and make two little slits, pop out the testicles, and toss them into a bucket. My dad is and was then a stubborn Swede. He appreciated all of our help. Again, we were an operation of 5, including 3 strong-willed daughters. But he probably should have asked for more help from other able-bodied adults. He didn't, ever. Yet, when I was a kid, I thought he was invincible. I thought he could fix anything. I thought he could grow anything. I thought he couldn't get hurt. Nothing. So one thing that really stands out in terms of the gruesomeness of farming is being up at the house one day and watching my dad walk up from the field just with his head bleeding, coming down his face, streaming down his chest. He'd been hit by a grain auger, and it had knocked him cold. He'd laid there passed out for God knows how long. We were probably plucking chickens at the house or something. And then when he came to, he just got up and walked calmly to the house. By the time I was in college, my parents were kind of phasing out of farming. Most of their girls were on their own completely by that time. They made more money. They didn't need to do all of this. Dad wasn't quite ready to give it up, though. So he turned the farrowing house into his wood shop, which is a whole other story for a whole other time. And the livestock including T-bone and ribeye, got moved out on the west side of the compound. Also out there, as part of the livestock, was a boar named Teddy. Teddy was aggressive, even as far as boars go. And as we've established, my dad was kind of fiercely independent and fearless and stubborn. Not the best combination. Kind of a disaster waiting to happen. And one day, that disaster did happen. My mom had already left for school. It was a weekday. My sisters and I were all out of the house doing our own things, in college or out on our own. Dad was out doing chores and probably moving pigs around or doing this and that, and somehow got cornered by Teddy. And as he tried to jump over the fence, Teddy came up and bit him right in the ass. When I first started jotting down notes about this story, my memory told me that my mom had taken him to the hospital that day. And I remembered a detail about him sitting in the cab of the truck on blood-soaked towels. Then I called my parents this week, and I was like, oh, you know, tell me again the story about Teddy. You know, Mom, you took him to the hospital, right? And Mom was like, oh, no. After my dad got bit in the ass by a boar, he went ahead and finished his morning feed truck route. Then came home, got cleaned up, laid some towels on the driver's side of the truck, and drove himself to the hospital in Galesburg. When he got there, the emergency room personnel was absolutely horrified at this injury and that this man had been walking around and doing all of these things he had been doing with this giant wound that took 30 staples to put back together. It wasn't a scratch or anything. It was a pretty serious thing. Later, after my dad's butt was kind of more put back together, he held Teddy in a hog catcher, and my mom cut off his tusks with bowl cutters. So when people tell me or give me that look, how idyllic farm life is, I usually like to start with the Teddy story. Soon after that, my parents got out of farming completely. While I complained a lot as a child and joke about it a lot as an adult, this thing about growing up as a freelance farmer, about the gore and the dirt and the chores of it, it really did give me a foundation of resourcefulness, creativity, humor, and hard work that serves me every single day. I am not nearly as capable as my father, but I'm not always as stubborn as he is either. So I like to think it gave me an even better foundation. I will try new things, figure out how to do things, but I will ask for help before I get bit in the ass by a boar. Thank you.
I still will see you, though, kind of like bounding off of the school bus and running across the prairie to go play with the piglets. Yeah, that was a great story. Jane. I'm going to perform a poem. It has nothing to do with farming. I have a captive audience, what can I say? But I'm the farm reporter, which I failed to mention, I think, at the beginning. But I'm the farm reporter at Tri-States Public Radio. That's why I'm here. And I've been here for about 15 months. And Rich Egger, who's the news director at Tri-States, has the way that he keeps morale high is he has this giant drawer filled with candy, chocolate candy. And it is there every day. I've had like 8 cavities since I moved to town. Thanks, Rich.
You're welcome.
But for some reason, like, the Dove wrappers have these little notes on the inside of the wrappers. And for whatever reason, one, you know, like I had just moved up my entire life, picked it up and like moved to Illinois to be a farm reporter. And like one of the wrappers that I opened, the first wrappers that I opened said like, you know, you're right where you should be. And I was like, oh, that's right, Dove. So I like put it you know, on my the little board thingy that I have next to my desk. And then, like, people just started giving me their Dove wrappers. And I'm not talking, like, a small number of Dove wrappers. I have, like, you know, I don't know, 150. We eat a lot of chocolate. So I said, I'm going to make a poem out of the Dove wrappers, and I've done it. So this is what you're about to experience. So the poem is basically how I think Dove is out to make everybody just like a really terrible person, a terrible lover, and a terrible employee. And it's the title is called "Damn It, Dove! I just wanted a piece of chocolate." They're all okay. Simply be rather than do. But if you're gonna do, do all things with love. Build a bridge with chocolate. Call, don't text. Like someone in person. Give them a compliment. Sweep them off their feet. And here's how. Actually go to a bookstore and buy both. Give yourself permission to take a run on the wild side. Treat Tuesday like Friday. Show up without a reservation. Be the first to hit the dance floor. Sing out loud, la, 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 la. Give yourself a standing ovation. Be playful with your love. Lend an ear and a chocolate. Learn something new. Stay up past your bedtime. Follow your instincts. Share something offline, like, you're delicious. Take this moment, enjoy it. Stay up until the sun rises. Sleep late tomorrow, do what feels right, ignore the clock, hit snooze times five, hit snooze again. You are exactly where you're supposed to be. Until you realize that someone is thinking of you right now. Probably your boss. Because it's actually Wednesday, not Saturday, because it was Tuesday night, not Friday night. But don't apologize. Give yourself the day off. Rock a bad hair day. Pack your rose-colored glasses. Tempt your sense of exploration. Get lost on purpose. Ride with the top down. Discover yourself. Feel free to be yourself. Keep the promises you make to yourself. Be free. Be happy. Be you. And if you had no idea who that is, improvise. What are you waiting for? Be fearless. Have no limits today. Be mischievous because it feels good. Go anywhere but home. But when you do go home, solve arguments with a dance off and get a good night's sleep. Thanks to Rich for the inspiration. Our next storyteller is Joel Groover. And Joel said that when he came to Illinois, he meant to grow sunflowers. But his vision is turning very orange, and now he's gotten into the pumpkin business. So here's Joel.
So sometimes I think my students wonder where I came from. They know I'm well-versed in corn and soybean production, but they also know that I did not come from the same type of farm that they came from. I came from Grooverland, which is a wild, diverse, back-to-the-land homestead in Maryland with small plots of fruits and vegetables and chickens and ducks and small amounts of grain that we harvested by hand. My roots in production agriculture, what I talk about, what I teach about today, they weren't planted until I was 16, when I started to work for Mr. Nevin. Mr. Nevin was not a typical farmer. He was a retired aeronautical engineer with big dreams. Every day he would read articles, he would draw diagrams of solar collectors and water pumping systems and all sorts of amazing things. But I also observed that he was an older man, driven at least partly by a fear that he was running out of time. And so he would spend money relentlessly. To the great dismay of his family, he would spend money with no concern because he had to complete his projects. I think his family also was sometimes concerned that just when they thought their father and grandfather was winding down his farming career, a young, tireless chief collaborator arrived. Someone who was as full of energy as Mr. Nevin was full of dreams. And so I enabled 6 more years of very expensive farming. The first summer that I worked for Mr. Nevin, I was one of 2 farmhands, and Robbie and I did epic amounts of manual labor. Mr. Nevin did the tractor work. We handled thousands and thousands of bales. The most formidable task, though, was waging war on the multiflora rose bushes. I don't know how many of you are familiar with multiflora rose bushes, but they get very, very large. And the only way to defeat a multiflora rose bush is to get into the heart of the multiflora rose bush, to the very base, and to attach a chain around the central canes. And if you're wondering how you get into the heart of a multiflora rose bush, I never figured out the right way to do it. But I would hack a path in, and I would attach the chain, and then I would attempt to wriggle my way out without getting too viciously, you know, cut by the very sharp thorns. And then with incredible satisfaction, I would observe Mr. Nevin start the tractor, and the chain would tighten. It was attached to the drawbar into the base of a multiflora rose bush. And with a sudden burst, this giant root system would get ripped out of the ground, and Robbie and I were ecstatic. And we did that over and over again, all day long sometimes. And eventually, we would have this incredible vision. We would see a fence row that had no multiflora rose bushes left. And that was incredibly motivating, and that kept us going all that first summer. Eventually, Mr. Nevin and I became pretty close, and he would let me do some tractor work. He still drove the big tractor, but he let me drive a little Ford Ferguson tractor, and I would mainly rake hay. And so one day I had been raking for hours, and I was just about finished. I'd done round after round, and the tractor started to sputter. It came to a stop. It was out of gas. And so I started the long walk back to the shop, and I had gone some distance when, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed that the tractor was not where I had left it. And I spun around, and I started to run because the tractor was starting to roll down one of the many long and increasingly steep hills on Mr. Nevin's farm. And I sprinted for all I was worth. Somehow, I don't know, maybe I was imagining that I would leap onto the tractor and apply the brakes before it crashed through the perimeter fence. I did almost catch up with the tractor, and then it suddenly swerved, not towards me, but towards the lone tree in the pasture, a tree that was right next to the fence. And I observed from a very close vantage point the front right tire colliding with that tree. And the tractor bucked up in the air like a bucking bronco. The hay rake lifted many feet off the ground, and then it swiveled, and it came to a stop against the wires of the fence, like a boxer on the ropes. And I caught my breath, and I realized that the tractor really had completely stopped. And so I walked back to the shop, and I got a can of gas. And I did not talk with Mr. Nevin. And I put the gas in, and to my great amazement, it started right up. So I backed away from the fence, and I parked the tractor back where I had parked it before, after I had finished that round, and I applied the brake. The next day, we had more work to do, more hay raking to do. Certain times of year when the sun, you know, is giving you an opportunity, you do a lot of hay. So I had done a couple rounds. Everything was working. I mean, it was just a fleeting memory what had happened the day before. And then suddenly I must have hit a little bump and the tire, the front right tire, popped off. And the tractor lurched forward, the axle dug into the ground, and of course everything stopped very quickly, and I almost got catapulted, but I held on to the steering wheel. There was no cab, there was no roll bar, but I held on, and then I looked up, and there was no tire sitting there next to the tractor. It was rolling down the same hill that the tractor had rolled down. And so this time I was going to win. I started running. I'm a runner. I thought I was going to catch this tire for sure. And I did catch up with the tire, but it was starting to bounce. And so I grabbed for the tire, and it bounced over my hands, over the fence. Not even through the fence, over the fence, and it careened down into a ravine through lots of underbrush. And I heard it smashing off of trees, and I heard the birds starting to squawk. And they're like, who is this intruder coming through our forest? And then at the very bottom of the ravine, I had lost sight of it long, long ago, I heard a splash. So this time I thought, I better go talk to Mr. Nevin. So I walked back, and Mr. Nevin, who was so driven to accomplish his projects, was actually a very gentle man. And he looked at me and he said, I think you should call it a day, but tomorrow you will need to find that tire. So I came back and I walked down through the ravine, and I could see bark had been removed and rocks had been dislodged. And then when I got to the stream, there was no evidence of the tire. It was completely gone. And I walked along that stream. I loved walking along streams as a kid. And I hopped from rock to rock, hoping that I would hop onto a tire, but there was no tire. I actually searched for 2 days. And I finally came back and told Mr. Nevin, I don't know what to say, but the tire is gone. And Mr. Nevin very gently said, I'll make some calls. Not for someone to find the tire, but he knew this was about a 40-year-old tractor. We're talking about in the late 80s. So this was an old tractor. He knew that it might be hard, but he would find a way to, you know, to source that part, and he found it. And so I had to make a long drive, hour-long drive, to pick up that tire. And I got it back, and we put it on, and we used that tractor many more times. And you could say that was the end of the story. But I also went back, and I walked along that stream periodically, thinking, someday I'm going to find that tire. But I never did. But I'm sure that tire will be found. Because there are no more fences. There are no more water lines. There are no more cows. Mr. Nevin passed more than 20 years ago, and his land is all developed. So there are big houses up on the tops of those steep hills, big houses with beautiful views, and there are children that live in those big houses that know nothing about what happened many, many years ago when that was farmland, but all children walk down through ravines and walk along streams and hop from rock to rock. And someday, one child will hop onto that tire, that tractor tire, and will think, where did a tractor tire come from? There aren't even any farms around here. Thank you.
Joel still likes to walk along streams. That wasn't just a childhood thing. A little more trivia. Y'all ready? So which state, tri-states, public radio, Illinois, Missouri, Iowa, which of these three states has had the most U.S. secretaries of agriculture? So for like the federal government. You said Iowa. Right. Iowa has had eight. There's only 33 of them. I think Iowa has had eight. Illinois has only had two, same as Missouri. So there you go, Illinois. Our next storyteller is Randy Sullenberger or Jer?
Sullenberger.
Randy said that he would have a small, diversified farming operation like his dad used to have. Randy.
Well, I'm a teacher, in case you missed the visual cues. I'm also a writer and a storyteller, but I started out a farm boy in the Knox County portion of the Spoon River Valley. And what I'd like to talk to you about tonight is the crime against humanity, which is the tasseling corn. And if you're not from a farming background, what detasseling is a key part of the process of hybridizing sweet corn. So what it involves is removing the tassels from the majority of the plants in a field of seed corn so that only certain plants pollinate the field, and that's how you get hybridized seed corn. Now, when my younger brother John and I were detasseling, the people who were afflicted with this abomination were junior high and high school kids. And so the first injury that was dealt to us was that we had to be in the fields by 6 a.m. So that meant you had to be out of bed by 5 a.m. So you get to the field at 6 a.m., you get on the machine that you ride through the field on. At 6 a.m., the corn is dripping with dew, okay? So pretty soon, you're soaked to the skin. And then you're chilled to the bone. I mean, you're turning blue, your teeth are chattering, and this is odd because this is going down over a 2 to 3 week period in July, which is the hottest and most humid time of year in West Central Illinois. But that particular torment is over by about 10 a.m. when the sun is pretty high up in the sky and replaced by another when you begin to bake. And you begin to sweat. And the pollen from the tassels falls and sticks to your sweaty skin. And it is a maddening itch. But you can't scratch it because both hands are occupied yanking tassels just as fast as they're flying by. And I'm not done yet. Because the edge of the corn leaves are like razors. Okay, so you're getting sliced up as you're going through the field. Think of it as the death of 1,000 cuts, only you don't die. Okay, you just get slashed over the course of the day, and your sweat gets in the wounds, and it burns like crazy, and it's very unpleasant. Very unpleasant. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you about the crews that my younger brother John and I worked on. So the first year that we detasseled, we worked with kids that we went to school with. You know, small towns like Williamsfield, Yates City, small farm towns. And, you know, with farm kids, and the crew leaders were responsible adults, like teachers, preachers, scoutmasters, these kind of people. The second year we detasseled, we got put on a crew with a bunch of yahoos, hoodlums, punks, thugs from the streets of Galesburg, who loved nothing more than a good old-fashioned brawl, okay? These guys were bullies, all right? And John and I were good boys. I mean, we went to Sunday school every week, you know? These are the kind of people we started to stay away from, all right? And so, literally, the biggest thug, the biggest bully of all was made the crew leader. Now, I cannot fathom to this day what the seed corn company was thinking when they put this guy in charge of a group of his peers, because he had no business being in that position, and I'm going to call him Jim, okay? And so Jim, he used his size to intimidate people and didn't necessarily have to be physical intimidation, but, you know, he would mock and taunt you on the basis of your size, your looks, your ethnicity, your cognitive ability, whatever it was, you know. Jim was not careful about the safety of the guys on his crew. I'm going to give you an example. So one day, we had to go down the road a little ways. You know, these are gravel roads out in the country. And so he was going down, and he played this game where, you know, we'd try to get in the car, and he'd pull ahead a little bit and stop. And then we'd catch up, and he'd pull ahead a little bit and stop. Pull ahead a little bit and stop. And so finally, he just says, just get on the trunk, you know. And so John and I and this other kid, we jumped on the truck, and Jim started driving like a maniac down this road, and he was swerving to one ditch, swerving to another ditch, and the gravel was flying, and we were holding on for dear life because we knew that if we got thrown off, we would be ground to bits, you know, on this gravel road, and we would have jumped off, except, you know, it would have been the same outcome. And fortunately, you know, Jim stopped, and nobody got hurt, and nobody flew off, but, you know, Jim thought it was the biggest hoot and everything. So that was Jim. Jim had a lieutenant, and his lieutenant was a little guy, and his name was, I'm going to call him Juan. And Juan was a warrior. Juan would fight at the drop of a hat or a nickel, which I'm going to explain to you in just a minute. And even though Juan was Jim's lieutenant, he was not immune to Jim's mockery and taunting. Jim used to call him my little enchilada. And it infuriated Juan, but there was precious little he could do because of, you know, the size difference. And so, okay, as far as the nickel goes, so one day at lunch, Juan stole a bottle of Squirt from another crew's car. So the kid who belonged to the Squirt came up and said, hey, how about you pay me for the Squirt? It was only a nickel, you know? So Juan takes the nickel out of his pocket, and he goes like this. He says, come and get it. So the kid took the bait, tried to get the nickel, and so Juan just starts throwing wild punches, like windmilling it. So they fall together, and they roll around down in the ditch for a little while. And nobody is really hurt necessarily, but it creates this atmosphere of tension and aggression, and everybody's charged up, including Jim. And for reasons unknown, other than it was, you know,
Jim's personality, he went after my brother, John, and he started pushing him back and pushing him back and pushing him back until John fell down. So I went over and picked up John, but I had not intervened. See, I was supposed to protect my little brother, and I didn't do it. It was my job to defend John, and I was derelict in my duty. I was not a brave boy that day, and I'm not proud to stand here and share that information with you. On the other hand, I'm going to reframe that whole picture by saying this. I used to work for a big corporation, and when the company had a setback or a loss, they didn't call it a setback or a loss, they called it an opportunity. So telling you this story has provided me with several opportunities. And so the first opportunity is to think about what it takes to be brave. Now, I always thought that I would be a hero when the time came, you know. I would punch that bully in the nose, or I'd attack that crazed gunman. The truth is, you don't know what you're going to do until that time comes. Fear and intimidation do funny things to the way you think and act, and it happens that quick. Fight or flight, fight or flight, fight or flight, and then it's too late. So I had the opportunity to learn a lesson about what it takes to be a hero. The second opportunity I have in telling this story is to make amends to my brother John. So I called him up. John lives out in Pasadena, California. I said, "Hey, man, I owe you an apology. Like, you know, it's long overdue. I didn't step up that day." And John said, "No apology needed." He said, "I tripped. I wasn't hurt. You know, if we had escalated the situations, you know, the way those guys love to brawl, it could have gone really bad for us really quick. And the way it turned out, you know, nobody got hurt. And so now something that's kind of been eaten on me for the last 50 years, okay, I'm rid of that now. Incredibly, I have the opportunity to tell you that apparently Jim and Juan have turned out to be pretty average, law-abiding citizens. You know, I mean, who'd have thunk it, you know? And it's sort of restores your faith in humanity. And so the biggest opportunity I've had is the aim that I had at the very beginning, and to share with you the truth of the legalized child abuse that goes by the name of detasseling corn. And I want to leave you with a quote from my favorite Civil War general, William Tecumseh Sherman, who famously said, "War and detasseling are hell." Thank you.
They call it corn rash. Yeah, it's bad. This is not a agriculture-related piece of trivia. So if you've really been vying for this stress corn, seed corn, who was Tri-State's Public Radio's music director before Ken Zonley?
There was no.
I think Barb. It was Ken and nothing. I did this earlier today, and she was like a cat. I mean, she just up. There was no forewarning. I just was trying to hit her in the head, honestly. Barb Haroon, everybody, who said when I asked her if she could farm anything, what would she farm? She said words, like a good English teacher. Followed closely by chickens, which I approve of. Barb.
So, as will become abundantly clear as I tell my story, I am a soft townie. And I became a soft townie when we moved to Macomb in 1980. And while I'm not a farmer myself, I have to say that sometimes I do think of the acres of pages and the nice, even rows of words as being what I till, and the young minds and the ordered rows. And I would be remiss, because I would not be here today if it weren't for one of my educators who's in the audience, Mr. Molden, who I have to say, I was a lackluster student in his class, but I was full of enthusiasm and great humor. And I remember going to get tutoring from him directly, and we were working on a story problem, which you think I would be good at, loving the words. And he finally stopped after 35 minutes and said, "Do you plan on using geometry in the workplace?" And I said, "No, I think I'm going to use words." And he said, "All right, then." So, Mr. Molden, it's so nice to see you. So, in 1980, I moved to Macomb with my wonderful parents and my two brothers. I was five. My older brother was seven, and my younger brother was three. And my story begins at Chandler Park, just down the road, my first ever Heritage Days. And we were there, ladies and gentlemen, hoping that luck was on our side in the getting of a pig. Because, and this is wonderful, and I love that Jane brought this up, this made me excavate my memory. I remember an auction. And yet when I called my dad said, "No, it's more like a drawing." And yet I do remember standing next to my father thinking, "Please let us get the pig. Please let us get the pig. I want to ride a pig." I really didn't think that we would get to ride the pig. Now, what we got was a piglet in a box. There's nothing cuter than a piglet in a box. I was five, and I was like, "This piglet is the cutest thing ever." And I remember my brothers and I, who did not unify over much. We were rabble-rousers, but we unified over this pig. We loved this pig. And the first mistake my parents made, who were thoughtful people, and my dad had deep ties to this area and had been raised on a farm in his high school years, but his father had always farmed. But the first mistake my parents made was that they allowed us to name the piglet. And I don't know who decided on the name Petunia, but as soon as that came out, we were all like, "Yes, it's Petunia! We love Petunia so much!" And that weekend, and like we'd wake up, we'd go look in the box. We'd be like, "What's the piglet doing? What's Petunia doing? Oh, Petunia! Petunia's sleeping! Shh, don't wake Petunia!" But the following weekend, we took Petunia up to my grandparents' farm. And as a child, filled with wonderment, because I think that's the natural state of children, particularly when they are allowed to be on the land, as we were allowed to do at my grandparents' farm. There was always a level of work. My parents heated our home with wood, and so we'd go up there every weekend as soon as it started to cool down to aid my father in the, he would be splitting the wood, we'd be hauling the wood to the truck, loading the wood, and then we would drive it home, and then we would unload the wood. And so there was always kind of labor involved, but it was fun, or we bickered and had a good time with it. My father was always saying, "Pay attention, pay attention. This is not fun and games. You could get hurt. Farms are a matter of life and death." And remember this, because this comes up later. But there was a level of labor, but when we were done with our work, we had free reign of acres and acres. And there was a creek that we would go and we would play in, and we would explore, and We were silent together, and we were loud together, and we were allowed to roam on our own, unaided, as long as we were back for dinner or when dusk started to fall, because that meant we were going to head home. And so it was a place of wonderment. And when we'd go up on the weekends, what we always would do would we'd clamor out to go see Petunia. And again, while we did not agree about much, we agreed that Petunia was the finest pig that there ever was. And she was the smartest pig that there ever was. And she knew each of us kids. And she responded to us, we swore in different ways. And we would fight over getting the longest branch that we could then scratch the entirety of her body. And her snout was a thing of beauty to me. Now, it should be noted that winter did come. And my dad was building a smoker in our backyard, and I was like, hey, look at my dad. He can, as Jane's father could, he can do anything. And then a weekend came, and my mother was hand grinding sausage. And I thought, wow, because that was, while it sounds strange, like she was just hand grinding sausage, it didn't seem strange to me because I was raised in a house, we didn't have television, we read, my mom was an artist, my dad was a man of words, and he used his hands to build things, and so it was just like, hey, mom's making sausage, yum! And we sat down to dinner and began to eat, and it was delicious, and it was like breakfast for dinner, which of course, as a kid, you're like, this is the best breakfast for dinner! And my older brother, who was 7 at the time, the age that my son is now, said, is this Petunia? Now, the last time that I saw Petunia, now it was winter, so we weren't going up to chop wood as much because we had cords and cords of wood. We had worked really hard. And so we hadn't been up to my grandparents' farm, and so we didn't really notice that Petunia was no longer in the round shed. In our minds, she was. And, of course, the answer was yes. And I know there were tears, and I remember my older brother, who was 7 and quite stubborn at that time, asked my parents, how could you do that? And he refused to partake of Petunia. Now, my brother, in keeping with this idea that really a farm is oftentimes a matter of life and death, when we were young and we were there all of the time and my dad helped my grandfather with harvest, one year my dad brought up the grain. Now, when he went inside, before he went inside to work with the attendant with the full bin of grain, my older brother asked to be set on top. He just wanted to sit on top because, of course, as a child, it looked like a mountain of grain. It looked like something that you should be able to walk on and sit on like a throne. And he had a orange, Hunter orange stocking cap on. And my grandfather had given him like 4 pieces of bubble gum. And so he was chomping on this huge piece of bubble gum. And he was sitting atop the corn. And my dad said, stay there. Don't move. I'll be right back. And of course, he went in to speak to the attendant. And while he was in, another young man came around to the back of the bin, unscrewed the big wheel, and the grain came rushing out. And of course, my brother was sucked down. And out of the corner of his eye, my dad saw this flash of Hunter's orange. And he turned and he ran and he jumped up on the wheel and he drove in and he was reaching for my brother and he got him by the shoulders and brought him up. And there was my brother coated in corn dust, his eyelashes even. And that bubble gum had saved his life. It was chock full of corn. And he spat that wad out, didn't even cry a bit, and life went on. And yet, on Thanksgiving, when I asked my dad about it, and he recounted the story for me, the terror that was so clearly on his face was one that, as a parent, I have known. It was a muscle memory. And he said, please tell me Joe does not remember that. So we're going to flash forward to then when my daughter was my brother's age and is the age that my son is now. We went to a dairy farm because, like me, they're soft townies. Although I do try to instill this love of land, and I do bring them to my grandparents' farm. They are soft townies. And we went to this dairy farm, and it was this magnificent afternoon. It really was. It was just, it was glorious. It was everything I could have dreamt and more. And then as the afternoon was ebbing away, the farmer pointed out Bessie. And Bessie wasn't producing as she should. And he offhand, in a very offhand way, said, you know, but so one of these days, Bessie's going to be a cheeseburger in your Happy Meal. Now, we are the type of parents who try not to do McDonald's Happy Meals, period, but that got through to her. And Anna, who is definitely my child, politely raised her hand and said, excuse me, sir. And he said, yes. And she said, could you please repeat yourself? And he said, Bessie here isn't producing like she should, so one of these days she's going to be a cheeseburger in your Happy Meal. And she said, that's what I thought you said. And a silence descended upon Anna, and I could tell she was thinking deeply. And we went into the dairy shed to have our chocolate milk. She refused that, and she wouldn't really talk. And then on the bus ride home, I said, is something bothering you? And she said, so cows, like the hamburgers Dad grills, like those are cows? And I thought, I have failed as a parent. And I said, well, sure, sweetie, like when we drive to the farm and we see cows, like they're livestock. Like livestock means like they're to be eaten. And she said, I don't think I want to eat meat. I think I want to be a vegetarian. Now, I am also my parents' daughter. And so when she said that, I thought, well, I have to respect this idea, right? And I have to see, like, can a seven-year-old be a vegetarian? Is that safe? Because there was so much I didn't know. And so I talked to her pediatrician, and then I started doing all of this research, and then I read this book by Jonathan Safran Foer on eating animals. And it changed me. And I thought, back to my brother asking that question, how could you? My parents butchered Petunia. My parents knew Petunia in the same way that I knew Petunia. My parents were able to look into the face of Petunia and then butcher her and feed us with her and honor her in doing so. And I realized that I'm not able to do that. I'm not as strong as they are. I cannot look into the face of an animal and think about eating it. So 2 weeks later, my husband's grilling veggie burgers for Anna and I, because I'm on the vegetarian boat too. We're rowing together. I'm like, sister, we're in this, right? Anna says, oh, mama, can't I just give thanks to the cow and eat the cow? And I said, why, yes, you sure can. And so 2 weeks in, she was out. 5 years later, I still can't do what she's able to do, or my parents. And that's okay. That's okay. But when I think about my parents and when I think about the gifts that they've given me, when I think about that, when I understand what they did, when I talk about this whole idea of my farm roots, the last time that I was at my grandparents' farm, it was with my father, and it was September. And even though this farm is only 48 miles away, and I try to bring my kids up at least 4 times a year, this was a day that was just for me and my dad. Because my father and spending time at the farm, that is the place where I learned that we all go to the land, and it is nothing to be afraid of. This is the place where I found morel mushrooms in the deep, dappled dark of spring. This is where I watched a log become dirt. This is where I was able to listen to all of the many layers of silence. This is the place where I sat on the porch swing underneath the giant oak that my grandparents' ashes feed, and with my feet planted there, pushing back and forth, realized that one day I will probably be called upon to put my father's ashes in that mix, to understand that this is the place that I've come back to, that this is the place that I'm as deeply rooted to as that giant oak, that this is the place that I find such glory in, because it is the place of my family. It is the place of my father. It is the home of my mother. It is the home of my beloved husband. And it is the home of my children. It's where I live. Thank you.
Is that your dad calling from Romania? Right here in Macomb, Illinois. Hello from Macomb. Hi, Dad. Who here is like a farmer or does farming? Go ahead, raise your hands. Yeah. So thank you. Everybody say thank you.
Thank you.
All you, what did you call them? I loved that. Soft townies. Us soft townies appreciate your hard work feeding us, meat and otherwise. So before we wrap up the night, I want to open up the mic to do a brief, I don't think I have any more trivia. No, I'm out of corn. If there's anybody in the audience who has a story that they are itching to share, looks like there's a couple of hands. Let's keep it a little bit shorter, under 5 minutes if you can. I am going to invite the lovely lady with the red sweater and the sunflower on her shirt. What's your name?
Wilma.
Wilma. Wilma. Do you want the stool? Do you want to stand? You'll lean on it? Okay.
This isn't my story. I think these have been wonderful stories told tonight, and it brings back a lot of memories. Mine's a true happening also. It isn't my story. It's my neighbor's story. And back in the 90s, I had gone to work early one morning, and I worked out at Western in the payroll office. And my husband called me about 10 o'clock, and he said, "You ought to know what's going on out here at Good Hope." And I said, and he tried to explain, and I thought, "What is going on? He must be nuts." Our son and his family had been up from Nashville, and I went to work at my normal time and let them get out of the house when I'm not there. And there was a little 5-year-old boy, and he was our oldest grandson, and he went out on our porch. We had a big 11-room house at Good Hope. It had the old-fashioned porches around it, and it was the home of the Doc Houston years ago. And we owned this house for 37 years. And he said, "There's an owl sitting out here on our porch railing." And I said, "What?" And we've had baby owls around there before. And he said, "The Macomb Journal's coming out to take a picture." And here I am at work having to miss everything. And all the neighbors was over there watching what was going on. And if anybody is interested in pictures, I have some pictures in here of the owl sitting on our porch with my husband's name on the wall of the porch, our little grandson watching, and there's some other pictures there. So when the journal came out, he said, "Have you named this bird?" And the neighbor woman said, "Jeremy." "Well, why would we call it Jeremy, you know?" Well, come to find out, she had had a nephew that had been raised up at Avon. He was in the service, out in Nebraska. And on the weekends, he would go out on a farm and work. And he was injured in a bad tractor accident. And he died. And the parents had been searching for a reason. And they felt that God was going to send them a sign. It was going to be in the sign of an owl. And they'd been watching all summer for it. And so she ran home and called them. And they were in Michigan visiting the grandparents. And she says, the owl is here. Well, everybody in the neighborhood started coming to see this owl. And I mean, people all over our big town of Good Hope would drive by and stop and look. And the owl sat on that railing. And then later he moved over on the other side and fell off in the flowers or whatever they were, lilies of the valley, I guess. And it sat there for a while. And then it would move around. Well, that night it moved around on the south side of the house. And there was a fence in its way. My husband went out and moved the fence. And he walked across our garden, up the alley, up through the neighbor's yards, across the railroad tracks. And we thought, well, that's the end of that owl. Next morning when I went out to go to work, he was back on our railing. And he hung around there on our patio, on the bird bath. Then he got up on our clothesline and sat on the pole out there on the end of it, right out toward the street. People would come by to see him. He would squawk at him. You couldn't get close to him. Some of the neighbors wanted to feed him. And we called Tom Dunstan, and we called somebody else. Everybody said, leave it alone. Don't touch it. It was a baby owl. Some thought it was an old one, molten. But it was a baby one. And if you got too close, it would let you know about it. It would sit there on that pole. And all the neighbors was watching to what was going on. And we'd get up in the middle of the night to see, is it still out there? And we worried about it getting fed. And I was up one morning at 5 o'clock, which is not my time to get up. And here came one of the parents to feed it. Of a night, you would hear it start yeeping. The parents would come in and feed it. It would move from the clothesline to the tree, up on the second floor of our house, trying to get in somewhere. This went on for days. And I mean, we talked to it like it was human. It wasn't just us, it was all the neighborhood. And finally, it moved from our house over to the neighbor's yard in a tree. And then after a few days, it stayed around there for 11 days. It moved around across the street in a tree, across another side of the street. And everybody watched it. We'd go out and talk to it. In June, we have our sodbuster days. And that night, some of us came home from after that, and it was clear across the street. And up in a tree, we couldn't see it. And everybody said, well, Jeremy, come down here. And, you know, he did. He came down and went up to the neighbor's door. And then later on, it went around behind the neighbor's house. And then the neighbor's dog got out, and we never saw it back in our neighborhood, but we could hear it of a night. The parents of the boy that died, as soon as they got back from Michigan, they came down. They wanted to see the owl. And she came down, the mother came, and then that night she brought her son and husband down. And they came two or three times. But this owl just drew our neighborhood together. It wouldn't have meant a thing to us if we hadn't known about this boy dying and what it meant to the parents. The neighbor women, several of them, wrote up stories, and I put it all together. And my story was published in a book that they had for something for the seniors out at Western, and I got honorable mention on it. And then I didn't write them. These stories wrote themselves, and you just got goosebumps reading them. And then we wrote a story from a children's story from an owl and how he was talking about these other birds bothering him. And what was these crazy people doing coming out talking to me? And, you know, it's just a story that still, and I have a letter that the mother wrote to me, and she says, I hope you get this published. Well, it's never been officially other than that one book. But if anybody wants to see the pictures of it, we had pictures to back it up and everything. And it's a good story, even if we did write it. But it was true, all of it. And it was a message to the parents, and they really appreciated it. So if anybody wants to see the pictures, I'll be glad to have a look at them. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that, Wilma. I'm pretty sure farming has the highest fatality rate of any profession, which is shocking. John?
Yeah.
Come on. This is John Lane. Are we snapping? The story says.
Well, I grew up over in Fulton County, and Tata was my first word, and it meant tractor. A big red Case International drove by my window often, and the guy who was our landlord and farmed a lot of the ground around there would go by, and starting pretty young, I could flag him down and hop on. And one time I did that when I was 6 without letting my mom know, and that was kind of a long day for everybody, but I had a great time riding with him for several hours while he plowed. But, you know, one time I was riding with him when I was 8, and we were down on the river bottom, which is kind of a long way from anywhere. You know, you could see 6 or 7 miles, but you couldn't see anyone. And he just switched over to beans, and he left his soybean head out over the winter, and so it was rusty, and it wasn't behaving very well to begin with, and then he dipped it in the dirt a couple times. And so he got down out of the cab several times and was cleaning it off, and the last time he grabbed for something to pull himself up on, and what he grabbed was the manual hydraulic release lever. And so he set the bean head down on his hip, and he was down there hollering, and I was back up in the cab, and I could sure hear him over the engine. And so I was pretty nerdy, and I was really into the machines, and I knew exactly what every control that I could see did in that cabin. So I hit the button, and it didn't do anything. And so I ran down there and talked to him and said, hey, you know, it's not working. And he said, you got to boost the throttle up. So I ran back up to the cabin, climbed back up in there and revved the throttle up. And he's, you know, still under the head, 4 feet from the wheels. And the little control that lets you toggle the head up and down is on the hydrostat, just like a riding lawnmower. And so, you know, I could have just as easily pushed it forward and rolled the combine over him. And it seemed pretty trusting, but I guess in retrospect, he didn't have a lot of other options. And he knew that I was pretty into machines. So I lifted the head up off of him, and then, you know, he was still fairly uncomfortable. But he had one of these early cell phones, and you couldn't call 911 back then, but I had a couple of the neighbor's numbers memorized. And so I called the neighbor and said, hey, you know, Kurt's had a bit of an accident. And so they called the helicopter, and they came right down and landed in the field down the river bottom. But the first person there was the lady I called, who was my local 4-H leader, and she was the wife of, I guess you could call them, you know, my friend Kurt's rivals. There were two farms, each of them over 1,000 acres, half a mile apart, in Fulton County, which has plenty of non-farm ground to begin with. And so, you know, I'm sure that these guys were competing for land and other stuff, and, you know, one of them had red tractors and one of them had green tractors, and they kind of had this classic rivalry going on. But she was the first person there before any emergency responders you know, she was there in 4 minutes flat, which probably meant that she was driving about 80, you know. And a lot of people came, and they sent him away to the hospital, and he was okay, but he was off of the equipment for the season, for sure. And I got a ride up the road back home to a neighbor, and my mom was in town, so I was there alone in the house, and I wasn't great at having feelings when I was 8, so I was mostly bemused and a little exhilarated. So I grabbed a soda out of the fridge, which was kind of a treat, and sat down to reread my favorite submarine battles in my favorite Tom Clancy book to calm down. And my mom got home, and knowing that she would be deeply affected by this, I tried to, as nonchalantly as possible, let her know what had happened. And she still threw up, but anyway, I go back to this every once in a while and try to see what it means. And one thing that I learned from it is that farming communities are tighter than they might seem, and though even though people are, you know, competing for land, competing for all kinds of stuff, you know, his rival, whose wife was the first one to arrive, organized the effort that harvested the rest of his crop. And there was a picture in Prairie Farmer magazine of 8 or 9 different combines in the same field. And his rival was the one to step up and choreograph all this so that every other farm family came over for one day with their combine and got it all in, and they had a big banquet, and it was pretty cool. And it was my first glance into the how alive the agriculture community is and how much they would step together and help each other when something really happened. And maybe something else that I learned is that the way that we farm now, you know, we use some incredible technologies, but they can be kind of double-edged, and it's really easy to feel like we're in control and everything will be all right when we're up in the cab of a big, powerful diesel machine rolling down the road. But, you know, that day I saw that these, you know, the power that we wield in our modern farming can really come back and bite us. And that metaphor is expanded to be a lot less just literal than when I first saw it. You know, now I think about compaction and all the different chemicals and inputs that we use and all the different ways that things can come back and bite us. But, you know, farming communities are very strong, and they stick together and they talk. And I have no doubt that farmers are going to continue to pursue the coolest practices they hear about and tell each other about them. And farmers really do care for each other, and they want to leave a good landscape. And they also support each other when bad things happen. So I often feel sorry for farmers because they're in the middle of a system that now spans across the whole globe, and you know there's a lot of things that are out of their control. But they can what they still can control is how they can help each other when somebody gets hurt. And so I'm not sure what I should take from this story, but you know, it's a thing that happened. Yeah.
I think that's like the story of humanity, right? Like we think we've got everything under control. I know Gil, and then I think Sydney, and then Lady in the Red, and then I think that'll probably be good for tonight. But I do encourage everybody to keep telling stories in the future. Gil, do you want to come up? Gil Bellis? Where's your cat? Where's the Cheshire cat?
This will be my defining moment on why I never went into farming. I had an aunt and uncle who lived in Indianapolis, Indiana. That was the home of both my parents. And my mom and dad and I and my brother lived in Detroit, big city. So it was a really nice treat for me 3 or 4 times a year to go to Indianapolis, where we visited all the relatives, including my aunt and uncle who had a farm south of Indianapolis. And it wasn't the kind of farm you might imagine from West Central Illinois. My aunt and uncle raised peonies. They had acres of white and burgundy and pink peonies, which in itself fascinated me. They also had a handful of sheep in a little corral and what today we would call free-range chickens. Our chickens, whose? All right, anyway, the chickens ran wild all over the place. In addition, there was a chicken coop for the chickens where they laid their eggs and did other things, I guess, wasn't privy to. Also, my uncle had in town a very successful restaurant and nightclub. That in itself didn't attract me too much. Except when a federal law was passed, and I have no idea what year this is. Here's a trivia question, I guess. When they outlawed one-armed bandits. So he had five or six of these in his nightclub that he now had to store in his chicken coop because he was not allowed to have them in the nightclub. And, of course, I'm a teenager, and I'm just fascinated by these one-armed bandits. And one day I went up to my Uncle George and I said, could I have one of those? And he said, I would love to give you one of those, but you put that in your car, your dad's car, and you drive back to Michigan. If you got stopped for anything, you'd be arrested for taking one of these across the state line. I believed him. I mean, I don't know that. I said, okay, are they still full of quarters? And he said, you know, I don't know. And I said, well, if I find out that they are, could I have all the quarters that I find in those five or six? Sure, it's been years since I cared. So you, if you can figure out a way to get into them and take the quarters out, you're certainly welcome. Okay, so 13, 14 years old, I can get into a one-armed bandit with no problem at all. I did not count on the head rooster of that free-range chicken group to want to protect its cachet of one-armed bandits. So when I went in there trying to investigate and break the code of how to break into the one-armed bandits, I got chased as much as I could, hated, you know, the coward in me, running like crazy away from now one or two roosters and a whole flock of hens chasing me all over the farmyard. And it was there that I had this defining moment that I was never going to go into agriculture.
Okay.
I feel him on that rooster fear. I've had it too. I have a quick addendum to Randy's story. I detasseled for one summer, and it was my proudest time because I really never felt like a farm kid. I grew up on a farm, but I had no idea what was going on, and I still don't know a lot about it. But I was very proud that summer, and I got on that bus at 4 a.m., and I had no idea who the heck those people were. I have to commend Randy for having the heart to think, I wonder whatever happened to those guys, because mostly I just wondered who these other children were. They were terrifying. Everybody seemed like they were 8 years old until we hit the cutoff when you had to be, I think you had to be 14 to go over state line. And so those were the really scary kids. I remember being on a platform, on the U-shaped platform one day, and I just remember being on there with two boys who were maybe 13. They were wearing full bib overalls, which is not something the kids normally did in the 90s. And they were, honest to God, chewing tobacco. And so I was just concentrating on my work, and they're talking, and I don't really remember them working. And then one of them goes, hey, are you a virgin? And I was like, oh my God. I just kept detasseling. And they're like, yeah, I bet she is. I'm like, yeah, what did you think? Come on, are you crazy? And that was the only time I remember being on the platform with them. But they were really scary, and the only thing I guess
concludes that story is that they don't really have children do that work anymore. They're not very good workers, so mostly it's migrant laborers.
Things women get asked. Okay, this will be our last storyteller. What's your name?
Marcia.
Marcia.
I grew up on a farm in northern Illinois, not from around here, Winnebago County, west of Rockford. And my dad used to say we lived 13 miles from the Wisconsin border as the crow flies. Some of you will know what that means. The story that I want to tell is after baling hay. Many of you remember all about baling hay. But the thing that we did after the bales got into the barn, into the hay mow, we kids in the summertime built tunnels. And as I reflect back to that, how on earth we ever did that or why we did it, I don't know. But we had the greatest time, and we would chase each other and try and hide. One of the other things that we did was where the hay was flat, the bales now, we would take out a set of bales, usually two sets, so there was two high and probably two or three wide, if you could picture that. Then we took binder twine and wove that across the opening and then sprinkled loose hay on top of that. Now you're getting the picture. Okay. Then we kids would take or invite some of our friends. They'd come over to play. We'd be standing here behind the trap. Come on over here. Psh, down they went. Now, this worked fine for most of the time. One time we had it all set, and I don't know why, but we got called somewhere else and left that all set up like that. My dad is up in the haymow, strutting along, doing something, and down he went. He comes to supper that night, sitting at the table, nothing is said, and all of a sudden he said, you kids been up in the haymow again today? Yeah, we were up there. Well, needless to say, that was the end of building those traps.
So thank you all for coming out tonight. I really don't think anybody who was involved in bringing tonight's event to stage could have fathomed that it would have gone this well or really fathomed what it would have been like at all. So thank you, everybody, for making it such a lovely experience. I hope it's something that can happen in Macomb in the future many times. It sounds like there's lots of agricultural-related stories that our community has to share with each other. I especially would like to thank the University of Illinois Extension. They are they have been the sponsors for the AgSense series, so thank you very much to them. Also to the Western Illinois Museum for hosting us and for their volunteers for helping set up the chairs and the food and everything, and for the co-op for keeping it tasty. Also, the Lane Family Band, and especially we should all be really happy that Chanelle could be here. She had brain surgery, like, not very long ago, and thank you, you know, the miracle of modern medicine for making that happen. Also, Monica Tate, Jason Shores, and Jeff Allen Young have been the puppeteers behind this whole show. They are graduate students at the theater department at Western Illinois, and they were the ones who worked with the storytellers and helped craft their stories that you heard tonight. Thanks also, obviously, to the storytellers for doing such a fantastic job and entertaining us this evening. And for the participants, if you want to see the owl photos that Wilma has, they're pretty remarkable. And lastly, Tri-States Public Radio. You know, this event wouldn't have taken place without Tri-States Public Radio. If you're not a member, we would love to have you become a member. We did a short little fund drive, but every dollar really counts. It goes to pay our salaries, and you don't pay for the radio that you hear, and you didn't pay for tonight's event. So if you want more things like this in your community, support Tri-States Public Radio. Thanks again.